that's a little flavor of the Times Square thing, Charles. I don't suppose we would expect people to be out, as they sometimes are wont to do on a New Year's, to watch the presidency come down in some flat iron tower someplace. It isn't really quite that sort of an event.
It's funny, people do seem to gather at events like this, and it's not because they really can expect to see anything. People have been gathering for the past couple of days out in front of the White House, as if almost they expected that there would be some visible sign when this thing took place. Of course, that isn't the way it works, but I think maybe people seek out each other's company and try to get out into crowds on an occasion such as this. It's just some instinct deep within all of us, I believe.
May well be. Let's get some of our first foreign reaction to the formality of the event as we now know it to be. In Tel Aviv, Bruno Wassertal is standing by. Bruno, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Reed.
Is there any official governmental reaction to, say, the fact that Ford is definitely going to keep Secretary Kissinger on as Secretary of State?
There is no official reaction, mainly because it's 5 a.m. in the morning here in Israel, and it's doubtful whether there will be some official reaction till Israel actually wakes up. There's satisfaction in Israel since Vice President Ford already made it plain that he would retain Secretary Kissinger as his chief Department of State man, and the foreign policy that the United States has followed thus far will probably be continued.
Bruno, what about, is there any reaction since it's 5 a.m., as you say, in the morning in Tel Aviv?
Hello.
I can hardly hear you. I think we're having the same problem Washington is getting to Alexandria, Virginia.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm sorry, Reed. Can you repeat that, please?
I was wondering, has there been any reaction at all, or was the thing, as it has been here, well known in advance?
I'm sorry, Reed, we cut out, but I assume your question, whether there has been any reaction at all, or a surprise. It came as no surprise to the Israelis, and the last parts of the scenario were pretty well known. It was just a matter of time before Watergate engulfed the president, though the drama of the final moments of President Nixon as President of the United States triggered the drama of the moment and, of course, surpassed any local news, even the tension on the Syrian front.
And that's the situation as we get it from Tel Aviv, Israel. Bob Pierpoint in Washington, how are things shaping up there? Any reaction coming in? Any thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that President Nixon, as he delivered his address from the Oval Office, did not have his family in the room with him. It had been thought originally that they would be there, but instead they watched from the private quarters of the mansion. And in fact, just before the president went on the air, he even asked the Secret Service men who normally guard him to please leave the room. He was told that one should stay, and there was some discussion about it, and we're not yet absolutely positive that anyone else in the room was there except the technicians who happened to be CBS employees who were in the room when he delivered the address. So the president, in effect, was alone with the American people. Now, around the White House here itself, obviously there's a somber mood. Many of his aides and members of his staff were huddled around television sets watching, others carrying radios and listening as they moved. And outside the White House, there was an interesting development in the beginning. Well, I think the thing to do, perhaps, is to have my colleague Connie Chung describe what's been happening outside the White House as she has been in and around this dramatic scene.
There are several hundred young people outside the White House on the Pennsylvania side, Pennsylvania Avenue side, They're standing around Lafayette Park, which is just across the street from the White House, partially because of the television cameras, but also they have come out with firecrackers and sparklers, and they're chanting and shouting their approval of the president's resignation. Many of them are standing in the middle of the street, causing extreme traffic jams on Pennsylvania Avenue right in front of the White House, and there are several people on the very side of the White House peering into the fence, watching and looking, trying to see what is going on inside.
Connie, that is quite a change, because initially, during much of the day today, there's been a very somber atmosphere outside the White House. And not only that, but in fact, there have been a sizable number of the president's supporters out there carrying signs, singing songs like "We Shall Overcome," and trying to convince themselves that the president would stay in office, and trying to convince him not to resign. Now, if I understand you correctly, there's almost a celebration by another group over the fact that he has said he will resign. Is that the way the situation is going?
That's correct. There's one group, the group that I was speaking of with the sparklers, and the other group is directly in front of the White House, and that group, of course, has been singing nearly all night long in support of the president, earlier asking him not to resign before he gave his speech.
We hope these two groups don't get too close together. We might have a different kind of fireworks out there. Connie, you have also been talking to some of the members of Congress who've been here at the White House. Could you report on that for us?
Yes, several members of Congress, both senators and congressmen, described as close friends of the president, handpicked, met with the president for about a half an hour before he gave his speech. He spoke with them for approximately 25 minutes, I'm told. Congressman Sam Devine, a Republican of Ohio, he's a member of the leadership in the House, he's vice chairman of the Republican Conference, and he's been in Congress for 16 years, said that the president choked up a couple of times as he spoke to the congressmen and senators. He spoke in the cabinet room and said this is the last time he will be in that room, his last speech. Congressman Devine also said that as soon as the president entered the room, everyone stood up and applauded him, and he asked that everyone join him in this tough occasion, and that everyone bear with him. Another congressman that I spoke with was Representative G.B. Sonny Montgomery, a Democrat of Mississippi, a man who supported the president, a man who said that the president was not guilty of any impeachable offenses until now. He resigns to the fact that he thought that perhaps the president should have resigned. Congressman Montgomery said that the president talked about ending the Vietnam War. He talked about his trips to Russia and to China and his accomplishments in the Middle East, as in addition to domestic matters. And he thanked everyone for their friendship and support. And he said that he hoped that he hadn't let them down.
Thank you, Connie Chung. Perhaps you'll go back outside and find out what is happening between the two groups outside the White House. Make sure that peace prevails out there and keep us posted, while those of us with CBS News around the country at our various listening posts perhaps talk a little about the future now. Neil?
Well, of course, the future is Gerald Ford, who will be taking over at noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow. And Reed Collins, I think you have some thoughts on that.
Well, we have some thoughts about the subject that we have sort of nibbled about the edges of. And this is the task that remains before incoming President Ford, to find another like he was and is today. Bob Schieffer has talked with our CBS News legal correspondent Fred Graham about the power of the presidency and about what a President Ford is going to have to do regarding the selection of his vice president.
Fred Graham, let me just ask you first, under the 25th Amendment, what happens next?
Well, right away, President Ford will send the name of his person, his nominee, to be vice president to Congress. And very quickly there will be hearings and a vote, and if that's approved by a majority vote of both houses, then that person becomes vice president of the United States.
And that goes through the same procedures under which the president selected Mr. Ford
under which President Nixon selected Mr. Ford to be vice president when there was a vacancy. We just do that all over again.
That's right. Of course, he was the first person to ever become vice president under the 25th Amendment. It's relatively new. 2 or 3 years old, I guess.
In a way, Richard Nixon played a role in, or at least was one of the reasons that the Congress came to feel that a 25th Amendment would be necessary.
Yes, Bob, I was chief counsel of the Senate Constitutional Amendment Subcommittee when that was first came under consideration, and I wrote then private citizen Richard Nixon, asked him to testify in the hearings. He didn't do that, but he referred us to his book, Six Crises, and then sent us written testimony, which went in the record and did contribute to the enactment of the 25th Amendment. It's rather ironic.
And, of course, when President Eisenhower was incapacitated for a time because of illness, Richard Nixon, as vice president, sort of served as an unofficial vice president.
That's right. He served
as an unofficial president, I should say.
Well, he served actually as an unofficial acting president, but there was no procedure then to make it official. Now, under the 25th Amendment, if Ford were to be in any way incapacitated once he gets his new vice president, then he could act as acting president officially.
And who becomes acting president if by some chance something should happen to President Ford before a vice president is elected?
Well, there's a statute that sets out the line of succession, and the next person would be the Speaker of the House, Carl Albert, and then the President pro tem of the Senate. Then it runs right through the cabinet members, starting with the Secretary of State, and right on down in their normal succession of protocol.
Let me ask you this, Fred. Does the Constitution also say that a person can only serve as president 10 years? So does this mean that Mr. Ford, assuming, or if he is elected in his own right in 1976, if he chooses to run, would he be eligible to run again then in 1980?
Well, Bob, another one of the ironies of this situation is that he is the first person to fall under a certain provision of the 22nd Amendment. You'll know that was passed when some of the people who disapproved of President Roosevelt's long tenure in the White House passed the 22nd Amendment, which says that no person can be elected more than twice as president. And he can't be elected, he can't serve but one term and 2 years of a prior term if he happens to become president by resignation or by the death of the president. And that means that he can only be reelected once under the 22nd Amendment. He will have been president only 6.5 years if he gets reelected, where any other person could have served 2 full 4-year terms.
Fred, in your opinion, has all of this, all of what has happened, damaged the presidency?
Well, you know, that was really the bedrock of former President Nixon's defense during the Watergate controversy. He said over and over that the presidency was threatened with erosion, primarily because of the rejection by the courts of executive privilege. But I always thought that actually the facts so disputed that, the legal facts, that one of the reasons why that argument was rejected was that in the courts there were a series of cases challenging overreaching or alleged overreaching by the president, not just President Nixon, but it happened in prior presidents. Impoundment of funds, over and over again claiming inherent power to take acts, alleged abuse of the pocket veto and such. And it appeared to me that most observers in this community felt that the presidency, if anything, had become too powerful with regard to the courts and the Congress. And we had a condition in the last 2 or 3 years where senators and congressmen were going into the courts and suing the president. That's never really happened that way in this country before. Number of suits in which the plaintiffs were members of Congress suing the president. And I think the reason that those arguments didn't carry the day was that there was just an instinctive feeling in the Capitol that the presidency, if anything, was too strong. And I think now, with no derogation at all to Gerald Ford, people will be happy to see a little more balance with regard to those three branches.
So perhaps in some ways it may really strengthen things. Would you agree with that, in that it does seem to demonstrate that the system works?
Yes, the system, as I said, it was interesting the way the courts and Congress suddenly were allies against the presidency. You know, there had been a long period in which Congress had been sort of the know-nothing element in this town, or allegedly so. Congress was forever trying to investigate someone on the grounds that they were communists or radicals, and Congress was passing harsh laws to crack down on criminal suspects, and the executive branch would usually take the side of the courts. That swung around in the last couple of years, and because there was, it seemed to be a lack of balance. Now, perhaps the three branches will be more in balance.
Fred Graham, thank you very much.
Our legal correspondent, Fred Graham, in discussion with CBS News correspondent Bob Schieffer, and our thanks to you both. Charlie Osgood, maybe you could catch us up now on what we've been discussing this night.
Well, in the event that anyone wonders why all this discussion, if you've been out of touch for a while, the big news of the night is that President Nixon, in a radio and television speech to the nation from the Oval Office at the White House an hour and 25 minutes ago, announced that he is resigning the presidency effective 12 noon tomorrow, at which time Gerald Ford, now the vice president, will be sworn in as the 38th president of the United States. President Nixon will be leaving Washington before that time. He'll be leaving tomorrow for California. By the time his plane gets to the coast, he will be a private citizen. Now again to Washington and Neil Strasser.
With me here in our Washington studio is CBS News correspondent Bruce Morton, who's covered the impeachment story from its inception on the House side, who has tonight heard the president declare his intention of resigning, and who has since been seeking reaction. Bruce?
Well, the people whom I've talked to this evening, Neil, have by and large liked the speech. They thought it was gentle, magnanimous, leaving on a graceful note. Mr. Nixon did not in the speech address himself to any of the things that were, either of the things, I should say, that were worrying the Congress today. The question of what becomes of the impeachment process, or the question of immunity. And in those areas, the reaction, because he didn't really go to either of those subjects, remains pretty much unchanged. Carl Albert has been saying all day that he doesn't think the impeachment process needs to go any further, that the Judiciary Committee ought to finish its report, lay out the case on the record, but there's no point in a vote, no point in a formal impeachment, consequently no point in a Senate trial. Sentiment in the Senate and House seemed to be weighted before the President spoke against the idea of the Congress, at least, trying to do anything about immunity for him, and that remains true. Republicans, I think, would generally say that it's going to be a little easier to campaign this fall. They and a number of Democrats think this really removes Watergate as an issue. In other words, a freshman Republican running for Congress in the 12th District and wherever doesn't have to worry that his opponent is going to ignore him and run against Richard Nixon and Watergate. That's down the drain now. Gerald Ford assumes the presidency as Mr. Clean, and that's a help.
One of those you talked to tonight, was it Roger Morton?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Secretary of the Interior. There's a feeling that he may play an increasingly important role in a Ford administration. Did he give any indication of that tonight?
He said he talked to Vice President Ford today, that the Vice President had asked him to stay on in the cabinet, and that he would, that he would be happy, as anybody would, to undertake any additional jobs that were offered, any additional responsibilities. And he had the feeling that I think, although I haven't talked to him, is general among cabinet members that this is likely to be a more cabinet-y administration than President Nixon's was. Less reliance on White House staff, more reliance on the men who were supposed to be in charge of the departments. The phrase he used was, this is going to be an exciting time for the cabinet.
The feeling was, among those informed observers during this day, that there would be a more open administration, was the phrase being used.
Well, I think so. That's Ford's whole tradition. He comes from the Congress. He's used to being buttonholed by colleagues in the House, by reporters in the Speaker's lobby, and he's used to talking to them when they tug at his shoulder and say, hey, wait a minute.
We recall that when he was first nominated to be Vice President, he made an appearance in the House radio gallery and said, if you will let me, I'll come back quite often, word to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been very approachable as Vice President.
Yes, I would look for a more news conferences. I'd look for more contacts, not just with reporters. I think we sometimes think that we're the only people who are involved in openness, and that's not true. But more appointments with people outside, more contacts with folks, with reporters, with government officials who aren't on the White House staff, just a wider range generally.
Bruce Morton, thank you very much. And back in New York, Reed Collins, Charles Osgood.
We're here, and we were reading just another statement that we mentioned. One of the senators some time back, a congressman who had to, or felt he had to sue the chief executive to get congressional business done. And Senator Kennedy, the Democrat of Massachusetts, has said the president's resignation clearly is in the best interest of the nation. I'm sure Congress and the country will close ranks behind President Ford as America enters a period of nation healing and reconciliation. And those words from Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts.
So far, it seems, Reed, as if virtually all of the reaction to what the president has said has been in the same spirit that the president's own statement was, and that is in the Lincolnian spirit of malice toward none and charity toward all. There really has been no bitterness. We've heard nobody say he had it coming or anything of that kind. In California, Governor Ronald Reagan, who has long himself and considered a presidential prospect, talked with reporters about the resignation of Mr. Nixon.
I think the president made the right decision for the country. I think when finally it became apparent that the outcome of such an impeachment would be a foregone conclusion, I then, as someone editorialized the other day, to go through the process simply for the sake of going through it didn't make much sense.
Governor Ronald Reagan of California. Reed?
The Reverend Dr. Carl McIntyre, a fundamentalist preacher and formerly an ardent Nixon supporter, has said that he's disappointed in the speech because the president did not ask the nation, he says, for forgiveness.
It was not what we expected or what we should have had. There was no sense of shame or guilt or humiliation on his part. He didn't ask the American people to forgive him. I feel that he actually insulted the moral conscience of this great nation, which was expressing itself in the Congress, and which forced him to his action.
The Reverend Dr. Carl McIntyre, who has in the past at least been a former supporter of President Nixon.
Many, if not most Americans, watched or listened to President Nixon's speech tonight. In San Francisco, CBS News correspondent Richard Threlkeld asked people in the street how they felt about Richard Nixon's resignation.
Mr. Nixon seemed to say that he wanted to heal the wounds of the country. Did you get that impression of the speech? Was it a kind of conciliatory speech?
I would say so. I'd say he was rather sincere. I feel that way. To me, it's an American tragedy.
In what way?
Well, whether you're Republican or Democrat, it's a tragic turn of events if this happens. It's like somebody in the family, not that I support him or don't support him, but somebody in the family, it's our president, it's your president, it's my president. It's just a tragic affair.
You feel sad at what he did? Do you feel happy now that he is out?
I don't think it's something you feel happy over. I'm glad he's not the president. I'm not happy that he had to resign or jubilant about the situation.
Have you been able to cope with all the developments today? You've seen the speech, you knew it was coming. What's your own feeling?
Well, I think, first of all, I think I'm kind of, well, I guess taken in by, overtaken by the whole thing. I think that it was a sad turn of events that he had to resign, and personally I think that his speech tonight was adequate as far as the Senate, the leaders in the Senate that wanted him to admit guilt and so forth. I don't think that would have served any purpose. I think that by judging personally the way I feel and the way that I think the other people felt by the sighs of relief that were let off when he did say that he was resigning, I think that that was totally adequate.
CBS News correspondent Dick Threlkeld with reactions from some people on the streets of San Francisco.
And so we've been discussing the resignation of the president who made his will and wishes known an hour and a half ago in a speech to the country. Took him just 15 minutes to complete the address. It took him only 60 seconds at the top to tell us what he intended to do, which was resign the office of president at noon tomorrow Eastern time, at which time the president-designate, the vice president, Gerald Ford, will take the oath of office there in the Oval Office, and he will become number 38. And it's as simple as that, Charles. It seems to me that the great weight of the moment has sort of escaped us in the relative simplicity and grace with which it all really happened. Neil Strausser?
We have one of our Republicans in the Senate looking ahead a bit to the political future. I'm sure you have noticed the comments of Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, who was one of the first Republicans to call for the resignation of Mr. Nixon, who now is looking at Gerald Ford and saying if Ford is able to curb inflation and improve the economy, and if he continues the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy, Brooke says, and we quote, no Democrat will be able to defeat him in 1976 because the country will be so grateful. We have a comment also from a member of the House Judiciary Committee, which, as you recall, last week completed its work on three proposed articles of impeachment. This is Brooks, not Brooke, Jack Brooks of Texas. And here's what he said about Mr. Nixon's resignation and announcement of plans to resign tonight.
It's my feeling, as one of the most ardent believers in the impeachment, that removal from office is the basic requirement of impeachment, the basic penalty. I think that he has resigned. I think that nobody really in the Congress on serious thought wants to make his burden any greater than necessary. I think that the report of the committee, the drafts of which will be ready in the morning for the committee members. Some of the Democrats are working on it now, and the Republicans and the people that have supported it, all of them now have indicated some support on the committee. I think that report must be accepted in some fashion by the House of Representatives so that it can become a document which lays out what the basis was for the Congress and for the committee's actions.
That was Jack Brooks, Democratic member from Texas of the House Judiciary Committee. With us in our studio right now, the Secretary of the Interior, Rogers Morton. Secretary, we understand you are going to stay on in the Ford administration.
Yes, I have been privileged to have been asked by, I guess, President Ford just tomorrow, Vice President Ford, if I would stay on, and I'm delighted to serve in any way I can.
Let me take you back one moment and ask for your comments on Mr. Nixon's speech tonight.
Well, of course, for me, it was a sad time. It was a great privilege for me to serve in the Nixon cabinet. And I know that the whole events of Watergate overrode and overlaid the other activities of the government, many of which I was very proud. I thought we were doing a good job in many areas. So it was a sad occasion for me, but I think that he spelled it out as he saw it. I think he was without rancor. He didn't. He seemed to have no bitterness in his heart. And I think there is a contribution that he can make. And so it was a thing that we had to live through. It was historical in every sense of the word.
Do you think, Mr. Secretary, that he committed an impeachable offense?
Well, I guess so, because based on the actions of the Congress, or at least the way it was, but it's a matter of a guess. I don't know what I'm not a lawyer. I was very uncomfortable with it. I felt that the thing was accelerated emotionally and in many cases beyond reason. But I know that the Judiciary Committee of the House worked at this thing and worked at it in good conscience. And I really am not a person to judge on that. I have great affection for Mr. Nixon. I've known him for a long time, and therefore I don't think I can make a judgment on it.
Mr. Secretary, as we talk here, we're waiting for the appearance of Ronald Ziegler, the White House news secretary, at the White House. So if I interrupt you suddenly,
I'll understand.
What do you look forward to in the Ford administration?
Of course, I look forward to the most exciting time in the world because our department is really beginning to write American history. We're beginning to develop the resources in a much more balanced way than ever before. We're beginning to accept the challenge of domestic energy. We're beginning to solve some of the difficult problems in our relationships with the American Indians. So I'm excited about what we have to look forward to. And I was excited about the same thing before all of this took place. So, but I just know that Mr. Ford is interested in what we're doing. I know that the Congress is interested in what we're doing. I look forward to a very keen relationship and a very friendly and cooperative relationship with the Congress. And I think this is going to have a very, very good effect on the performance of government across the board.
Will it be a different kind of administration?
Yes, I think it will. I think it'll be a more open administration. I think it'll be an administration with a great deal more congressional involvement and congressional communications.
Do you think you will be closer to the president, to the new president, than you were to the one who was going
out? Well, I think that closeness is a very hard thing to define. I was always able to communicate with President Nixon. I was always able to get time when I needed it, and I always worked well with his staff. And I'm sure that this will be the case with Mr. Ford. Jerry and I are old friends. We've known each other a long time. I came into the House just as he ascended to the minority leadership. He's very much interested in what we're doing, so I look forward to a very fine relationship.
You are, of course, another who began your relationship with the Vice President in the House of Representatives. This is one of his great strengths.
I think so, too. You know, Gerald Ford is a man of destiny. We're history has given him to us at a very, very appropriate time. He is a person who's just as solid as he can be, and yet he has all the sensitivity, I think, that is needed for leadership. I just think we're a very fortunate nation to have him under these circumstances.
And if I can turn you to politics for a moment, what now is going to happen in the 1974 congressional elections?
Well, following some of the analysis that George Bush has made, I never felt that we were down on our uppers to the extent that a lot of people implied. I felt that we were doing better, and I also feel very strongly that the personality and the general impact of the man himself, the candidate himself, is a very determining factor in who wins an election in this day and age. And I think we're going to do well. I think the program is good. I think we've got to wrestle with the problems of the economy. We've got to wrestle with inflation. But if we make a conscientious effort to do this, and we will make that effort, I am just sure that we're going to do well in the fall.
Would you have done so well if Mr. Nixon had not left office?
Well, this is a speculation. So we would have done as well, or so we wouldn't have done as well. What good does that speculation do? I don't know. I think there's no question about the Watergate cloud was over the administration. We have been now relieved of that. And through a very, very fine action of the president, he put the national interest first. And obviously, I think this enhances our position.
Secretary Morton, thank you very much for coming up and talking to us this evening after these momentous developments of the past 1 hour and 40 minutes now. At the White House, we are still waiting for the appearance of Ronald Ziegler. Suppose we bring back in Reed Collins and Charles Osgood, and we'll interrupt you, gentlemen, if we see Ronald Ziegler.
All right, why don't you do that, Neil, and you'll be interrupting us and Paris also. Our correspondent, Peter Kalischer, is going to join our conversation in Paris. Peter, are you there?
I'm here.
You, your current base of operations recently, through death, passed the torch, President Wise, and I wonder what the Parisian view of the doings in Washington tonight may be.
Well, they haven't been apprised, or at least, let's say, they haven't heard the president. It's still in the early morning hours here, and it wasn't put on the air. But I think you can say that France will be less affected by the passing of Richard Nixon in the White House as in the manner of his going. As far as the French go, American foreign policy is wrapped up in Henry Kissinger. And now that Richard Nixon has left and Kissinger remains, the French are pretty certain that there's not going to be any change. There's sometimes close, sometimes irritating relations the two countries will go on as before.
Is there any indication that France might alter its view now in view of what might be a supposed interregnum weakness on the part of the United States, might France conceivably get a little further away as a NATO ally, for example?
I doubt it. I think that as far as a military NATO ally, France is as far as it can get, and it's going to stay there. Economically, the only effect that we've been able to see in the last few days is the dollar gaining against the franc as the prospect of Nixon's resignation increased.
But there have been no crowds down in the street singing adieu, adieu, as they one time did to the late President de Gaulle?
Hardly. First of all, Paris is a deserted city. It's August. Everybody's on vacation. The crowds in the streets are tourists.
Not Frenchmen.
Peter? Not that you can see them in a crowd. And the fact that the Frenchman is caught in Paris, he probably denies he's a Frenchman because it's embarrassing being here.
I see. I didn't know it was bad form to be a Frenchman in Paris in August, but...
terrible form.
A terrible form. Peter Kalischer, it was kind of you to join us at this wee hour in Paris, France.
Reed, it seems that the effort on the part of President Nixon and also Vice President Ford to create the impression that there is going to be continuity here, that the policies are going to stay the same, have been successful. The people that we've talked to seem to expect that there aren't going to be any major changes. Among the things that were done to emphasize the continuity are statements that were made in the course of the day, in some cases off the record, not for recording, but statements to the effect that as far as the Defense Department was concerned, there was not going to be any special emergency alert issued. As far as the State Department is concerned, Vice President Ford spent an hour and 40 minutes with Secretary Kissinger, and then tonight, in the one concrete announcement that he had to make, said that Secretary Kissinger would continue as Secretary of State. And I think that is really all that it would take to reassure on the most important international questions the peoples of the world.
That and the tremendous communication capacity we now have, only deep tragedy seems the intervention of tremendous events catches the world by surprise. They knew, this nation knew, probably yesterday and of a certainty today, and hours before the event, the coming of the event. So I suppose that accounts for Europe sleeping and Tel Aviv sleeping and not really having to react to an event for which they had the shadow falling across them days before. Let's get back to the issue of the president's former cabinet men who are sustaining their loyalty, many of them at least, to their former chief. Dan Blackburn of CBS station KNX in Los Angeles has talked to two of them.
One of the president's oldest and closest friends says he feels Mr. Nixon rose to meet the demands of the occasion and delivered an excellent, if tragic, farewell address. Former White House counselor and one-time health, education, and welfare secretary Robert Finch, who was once described as almost a brother to the president, says that he watched the speech with a deep sense of sorrow.
A tragic occasion for the whole country when we have, for the first time, incumbent president step down. And even though I've been away from the White House for 2 years, most of us, all citizens, have an open sense of the nature, the unique nature of that office, I guess, most important in the world, which we never escape. And so it's a sort of a combination of sorrow and hope.
Finch adds that he believes Vice President Ford will restore a sense of unity and purpose. He is among many longtime Nixon friends in Los Angeles. Another is the president's former communications director, Herb Klein, who was recently on the receiving end of some sharp presidential comments in the latest batch of White House tapes. Klein voices regret at the resignation.
I watched the speech with a great deal of emotion about it. I felt very badly for him. I feel very badly for the country that he's had to step down. He's had a tremendous career, and I think the fact that a mistake was made early in the Watergate situation where it wasn't cleared up and exposed to the public has brought down a man with this type of thing. I think the encouraging thing is that fortunately the country is set up with a system so that we have a strong vice president, one who I think will carry on policies which have been successful both internationally and domestically.
Klein suggests that Mr. Nixon might someday in the future be given a special post as a roving ambassador to serve the nation further in the area in which he is most experienced, that of foreign policy. This is Dan Blackburn for CBS News in Los Angeles.
Neil Strausser?
Here in Washington, continuing comment on the announced plan, Mr. Nixon to resign and the coming succession to the presidency of Gerald Ford, Republican Senator John Tower of Texas, who was one of Mr. Nixon's strongest supporters in the Congress until this week. Tower said that Ford is a creature of the Congress and he has no scars in his relations with us, and relations with him will be very good. Representative Bella Abzug, the Democrat of New York, an outspoken supporter of impeachment, said constitutional government and the impeachment process had been vindicated by President Nixon's announcement that he will resign. She said, the would-be king is gone, long live the presidency. Representative Robert McClory of Illinois, the second-ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, and the man who voted for two of those proposed articles of impeachment, with great regret, said of Mr. Nixon's announcement that I'm very grateful for that decision. I think the people now will stop and reflect on his great accomplishment as president, and he will have a great deal of opportunity to reestablish his stature as world leader. Those are the comments of Robert McClory. And I think, gentlemen, we might pause to think about Mr. Nixon's place in history as we get on, far on, down the road on this. How much better it might have been had he been a one-term president. It's happened so often, a couple of times in this century at least. We think of the domestic achievements of Lyndon Johnson in his first few years, and the domestic achievements of Woodrow Wilson also in his first term before the World War I years. In the House gallery now is CBS News correspondent Al Walker, and Al, I assume you've been getting reaction there.
Yes, Neil. We talked to a few of the congressmen on the House side, but some of the more influential ones. Carl Albert, the Speaker of the House, came up. John Rhodes, the Minority Leader. Jack Brooks, I heard you quote some of Jack Brooks' reaction to the speech. Generally, here on the House side, the reaction was quite favorable to Richard Nixon's farewell address. The congressmen seemed to think that it was conciliatory. They pointed to the part of the speech where he was willing to admit his own mistakes, and they all seemed relieved that, as some had suggested or anticipated, that he did not take the tack of turning upon the Congress or trying to blame them for hounding him out of office. And so the question was on the mind of many, seems to be answered, that there is no mood, there is no stomach for the continuation of the impeachment process from this side to continue to hound private citizen Richard Nixon any further.
They didn't, Hal, get the confession of error that that some wanted, at least not in very direct terms. Mr. Nixon, as I recall, said that some of his decisions have been wrong, but they were made in what he thought was the best interest of the nation, which was about the only direct comment he made on his Watergate troubles.
Well, that seemed to be enough, Neil, for the legislators up here, who I think generally, in spite of some of the rhetoric we heard earlier, really did not have a great stomach for continuing the process of impeachment. It was interesting, too, in talking to John Rhodes, the minority leader now, we got some of his thoughts about what may have happened to Richard Nixon in his presidency. It was Rhodes who suggested that perhaps Richard Nixon, in a preoccupation with the peace of the world, that may have been his undoing. Rhodes suggested that because of such a preoccupation that Richard Nixon left unto others some of the important work that he himself perhaps should have taken to task personally. Rhodes was among those called to the White House prior to Richard Nixon announcing his decision, and it was a very interesting and personal insight into what he thought was the thinking of Richard Nixon.
Of course, that was one of the original explanations offered for the Watergate affair on the part of Richard Nixon in one of his early speeches when this whole thing began to break, and yet we must recognize that those tapes, even those made public this week,
of conversation 6 days after Watergate showed a great attention to detail on many points not having to do with world peace.
That's true, Neil. I was just thinking that one of the other things that Rhodes said as part of his conversation with the president, again, some of the insights of the things that were going on in those days when so many rumors were flying, when the leaders, the congressional leaders, were called to the White House yesterday, he seemed to suggest that what Richard Nixon was looking for, what President Nixon was looking for at that time, was a confirmation, an actual confirmation from the people up here as to what his status was in the Congress. And Rhodes indicated that it was rather his sad duty to tell Richard Nixon what so many people seemed to know already, that he really did not stand a chance of avoiding an impeachment vote in the House, and that it was up to the Senate leaders to indicate to him that his fortunes were really nil on the Senate side. And then with that confirmation, Rhodes seemed to suggest to us that the final decision became concrete in the president's mind.
Well, I'm just curious. We've had so much comment from the House itself tonight. Did many of the representatives just simply stay in their offices to watch the speeches?
No, not too many. There are not very many people around Capitol Hill tonight. The leaders stayed because we specifically asked them so that we could have their reaction here in Capitol Hill. No, I think this was a private night for most of the legislators who, in spite of their differences, I'm sure, felt the full gravity of what was going on here tonight. And it was not the sort of thing that they really felt, I guess, they wanted to share publicly. I think most of the members of the House and the Senate were at home, I guess, with their own families, like so many other Americans, as this news broke upon them.
Let us switch over to the Senate side now with the proviso that, again, we think that Ronald Ziegler is close to appearing at the White House, but let's switch over for the moment to George Herman on the Senate side.
And here I am on the Senate side. You just let me know when Mr. Ziegler appears. Neil, I've been talking to a series of senators. In answer to the question that you asked, Hal, quite a number of senators stayed here, watched Mr. Nixon on their television sets in their offices, and then came out onto the plaza where all three networks have their cameras and their microphones set up and granted interviews and talked to us. And if I had to sum up, let's say, five interviews, I would, into a single sentence or a single, distill it into a single emotion, I would say that they were moved by the president's resignation. In general, they were a trifle disappointed that he did not address himself more directly to the question of his own personal guilt or innocence, but simply contented himself with saying that his political power base had eroded in the Congress and he didn't feel he could carry on his fight for vindication. Quite a number of them had hoped that in this speech he would clear the air a little bit more by making some direct reference to his role in some of the still disputed Watergate matters. But in general, they felt themselves much moved by what had happened. They felt that they should let some dust settle and let their own emotions cool and recollect all of this in tranquility before they gave a definitive impression, a definitive answer on how they felt. One man, one exception, was Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, who, as you know, today introduced into the Senate a bill calling for a joint congressional resolution saying that it was the sense of Congress that the president should not be prosecuted anywhere else for anything that may have happened in the Watergate case. And I asked Senator Brooke whether he thought the speech had done the job, because Brooke said today that if the president did not admit to some guilt, some culpability before the nation, he would not press his resolution. And Senator Brooke, although moved and saddened by the president's speech, said no, the speech did not meet that qualification. And he said he would not now press the bill for immunity for the president. He said it would go to the judiciary committees of both houses, but he felt it would not muster a majority in either committee. And I asked, would it muster the vote of Edward Brooke of Massachusetts? And Edward Brooke of Massachusetts said in one word, no. So that particular bill for immunity for the president now seems, because of the wording and the tone of the president's speech, that particular bill for immunity may be dead. But there are others who think that no matter what happens now, we should put Watergate behind us, and we should free the president from the and the nation from the spectacle of future prosecutions from having Mr. Nixon, an ex-president of the United States, as he will be tomorrow, dragged through court after court, and they may try to revive the Brook bill for immunity in some other fashion.
George Herman, thank you very much. Let's go back to Reed Collins in New York.
And thank you, Neil Strauser and George. Our live CBS News coverage of the resignation of President Richard Nixon will continue, but right now we're going to pause for station identification.
KOIN in Portland.
Real hijackers.
King of the road.
Gerald Ford is 61 years old, born in Nebraska, raised in Michigan. During the Senate hearings last fall on his nomination to succeed Spiro Agnew as vice president, he characterized his political philosophy this way.
I consider myself a moderate, certainly on domestic affairs, conservative on fiscal affairs, but a very dyed-in-the-wool internationalist in foreign policy.
John Hart has taken a look at Ford's voting record during the years he served in Congress.
When it came to money, Ford made conservatives happy and liberals unhappy most of the time. He wanted protection on trade, less foreign aid. He voted against a minimum wage bill his first year in Congress, and again in 1960 and 1966 and 1973. He voted against public housing and rent subsidies. He voted against federal aid to secondary schools and for aid to universities. He voted against Medicare and the rat extermination bill, saying the rat bill would benefit only 2.5% of the people. He voted against money for mass transit, model cities, and urban renewal. He voted against creating the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And he voted against the war on poverty when the Office of Economic Opportunity was created in 1964. Ford voted against farm supports frequently, and for a number of business supports. The government guarantee of $250 million loan to Lockheed when it was in bad trouble, and he tried to keep the supersonic transport alive. As for labor, the AFL-CIO figures Ford voted wrong most of the time. He voted to keep right to work in the Taft-Hartley law, and he voted against workmen's compensation for migrant workers. His record on civil rights is more liberal than his reputation. The NAACP saying he wound up voting for a lot of civil rights bills that he tried all along to defeat and couldn't. When Sam Rayburn was Speaker of the House, he used to tell new congressmen, to get along, go along, and Ford seems to have done that most of the time.
John Hart. Our congressional correspondent, Roger Mudd, takes a more personal look at Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford is what he is. He is a conservative, small-town Midwesterner, business-oriented with a good education. This means he is not exciting, but he is reliable. He is not funny to be with, but he's pleasant and of good cheer. He is not quick, but he is careful. In short, he gives the impression of quiet competence, vigor, sincerity, and unswerving integrity. Perhaps too much has been made of his intellect or alleged lack of it. It is fair to say simply that he is not a philosophical person. His mind does not bend that way, and during many days of public hearings and innumerable chances to ruminate about the world, the nation, the presidency, and the Congress, Ford never once answered in a philosophical or contemplative way. Nonetheless, Ford's nomination was never in real danger on Capitol Hill, even though his detractors said the country could do better. Even Clarence Mitchell, the Washington director of the NAACP and a critic of Ford's civil rights voting record, recently gave Ford the highest accolade a politician can bestow. He is, said Mitchell, the sort of man I'd be glad to go hunting with. I know I wouldn't get shot in the back.
Roger Mudd. As he left his home in Virginia this morning to begin a day that will see him sworn in as the nation's 38th president, Gerald Ford had these thoughts.
A feeling of sadness on the one hand and expectation to start to build on the other. It does strike me as a terribly heavy responsibility, which we're going to try and work on and do our very best.
Now, this message.
It's acid indigestion and this pressure. It's gas again.
Digel has told you acid indigestion and heartburn are often accompanied by gas. Now, a report from the U.S. government confirms that the only ingredients recognized effective against both acid indigestion and gas are an antacid combined with simethicone. That's exactly what Digel is. No antacid alone relieves like Digel does. Use only as directed. Digel,
relieves acid indigestion, relieves gas, too.
I'm Johnny Bench. I play baseball, so I keep my body in good shape. I like to be well-groomed, too. So I switched underarm sprays till I found one that gives me what I want. New Body All Powdery Spray without talc. I get the comfort of powder, yet it's almost invisible on my skin. And the deodorant, like it says on the label, is micro-encapsulated. So it keeps releasing fresh deodorant at the first hint of moisture. New Body All Powdery Spray without talc. I'll never switch again.
Newsbreak. I'm Gary Shepard, CBS News.
Several minutes, the persons invited to this historic swearing-in ceremony have been filing into the East Room. They're members of Congress, the leadership, members of the Nixon cabinet, and we understand many of those members of the Nixon cabinet will continue on as part of the Ford cabinet. Melvin Laird is here. Melvin Laird, about whom there's been so much speculation as a possible vice presidential nomination. There is no sign. Oh, I do see at this moment John McCormick, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, where Gerald Ford spent so much of his public life and his career, has just come in. We heard the helicopters landing on the South Lawn a few minutes ago, and we understand that former Speaker John McCormick was flown here for this occasion. He is in the process at the moment of talking with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and present Speaker of the House, Carl Albert. The East Room, Neil, is as full, I think, as I've ever seen it. It is jammed full with reporters, with photographers, with cameramen, and there's just not an inch of space anywhere except the focus, the center of the room, where we are waiting for the new president, Mr. Gerald Ford, to be sworn in by the Chief Justice Warren Burger. And Mr. Ford will be accompanied here by members of his family. They will be arranged, as we think they've laid out spaces on the stage for the family to be arranged around the new president as he takes his oath of office as the 38th president.
Gerald Ford has emphasized his congressional background by inviting the leadership of the Congress, members of both parties, to be here for this affair. There is also some of the trapping of the more formal inauguration we're familiar with on January 20th. Members of the Diplomatic Corps are in the East Room. And, of course, as you mentioned, members of the, we must now call the Ford cabinet. We know at least that Secretary of State Kissinger is staying on. Last night, the Interior Secretary, Rogers Morton, told us he'd been asked to stay on and would gladly.
Neil, among the guest list here, there's an interesting group called the Transition Group, which consists of Bryce Harlow, a counselor to President Nixon, Bill White of the U.S. Steel, and Phil Buchan, a Grand Rapids attorney and longtime friend of Gerald Ford, and a couple listed as Mr. and Mrs. Bill Scranton. And now,
of the United States.
Warren Burger is being introduced, the audience rising. The Chief Justice flew back this morning from a vacation in Holland to administer the oath to Gerald Ford. Everybody waits. He has not yet appeared in view of the standing audience. Already on Capitol Hill, the Senate has passed a resolution calling Gerald Ford a good and faithful friend and pledging the cooperation of the Congress as he assumes the presidency. That resolution introduced jointly by the Republican leader Hugh Scott and the Democratic leader Mike Mansfield.
And now
the Chief Justice Warren Burger in his black robes is making his way up to the podium at the front of the East Room, standing by one of the yellow chairs.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States and Mrs. Ford.
Last time we saw Gerald Ford this morning, he was
on the south lawn of the White House, bidding goodbye to Richard Nixon, who is now flying westward. Now he's making his way into the East Room. Past the applauding standing members of the audience. Up onto the podium with his wife. In a light blue dress. Stands between Gerald Ford and Chief Justice Warren Burger.
Mr. President, are you prepared to take the oath of office as President of the United States?
I am, sir.
If you will raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Justice, the first person possibly to speak those words. Congratulations, Mr. President. Gerald Ford, his wife, now the Chief Justice.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Mr. Chief Justice, my dear friends, my fellow Americans, the oath that I have taken is the same oath that was taken by George Washington and by every president under the Constitution. But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans. This is an hour of history that troubles our minds and hurts our hearts. Therefore, I feel it is my first duty to make an unprecedented compact with my countrymen. Not at an inaugural address, not a fireside chat, not a campaign speech. Just a little straight talk among friends. And I intend it to be the first of many. I am acutely aware that you have not elected me as your president by your ballots. So I ask you to confirm me as your president with your prayers. And I hope that such prayers will also be the first of many. If you have not chosen me by secret ballot, neither have I gained office by any secret promises. I have not campaigned either for the presidency or the vice presidency. I have not subscribed to any partisan platform. I am indebted to no man and only to one woman, my dear wife. As I begin this very difficult job, I have not sought this enormous responsibility, but I will not shirk it. Those who nominated and confirmed me as vice president were my friends and are my friends. They were of both parties, elected by all the people and acting under the Constitution in their name. It is only fitting, then, that I should pledge to them and to you that I will be the president of all the people. Thomas Jefferson said the people are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. And down the years, Abraham Lincoln renewed this American article of faith, asking, is there any better way for equal hope in the world. I intend on next Monday next to request of the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President pro tempore of the Senate the privilege of appearing before the Congress to share with my former colleagues and with you, the American people, my views on the priority business of the nation, and to solicit your views and their views. And may I say to the Speaker and the others, if I could meet with you right after these remarks, I would appreciate it. Even though this is late in an election year, there is no way we can go forward except together, and no way anybody can win except by serving the people's urgent needs. We cannot stand still or slip backwards. We must go forward now together. To the peoples and the governments of all friendly nations, and I hope that could encompass the whole world, I pledge an uninterrupted and sincere search for peace. America will remain strong and united, but its strength will remain dedicated to the safety and sanity of the entire family of man, as well as to our own precious freedom. I believe that truth is the glue that holds government together, not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though stained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. But there is a higher power. By whatever name, we honor him, who ordains not only righteousness but love, not only justice but mercy. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate. In the beginning, I asked you to pray for me. Before closing, I ask again your prayers for Richard Nixon and for his family. May our former president, who brought peace to millions, find it for himself. May God bless and comfort his wonderful wife and daughters, whose love and loyalty will forever be a shining legacy to all who bear the lonely burdens of the White House. I can only guess at those burdens, although I have witnessed at close hand the tragedies that befell three presidents and the lesser trials of others. With all the strength and all the good sense I have gained from life, with all the confidence of my family, my friends, and my dedicated staff impart to me, and with the goodwill of countless Americans I have encountered in recent visits to 40 states, I now solemnly reaffirm my promise I made to you last December 6th to uphold the Constitution, to do what is right as God gives me to see the right, and to do the very best I can for America. God helping me, I will not let you down. Thank you.
Gerald Ford has made his first address as the nation's 38th president. He stands now, right arm around his wife, smiling, acknowledging the applause of this audience. Members of the cabinet, members of the White House staff, diplomatic corps, leaders of the Congress present for this occasion. It's notable that the vice president, or the president now, has stated that he will seek the privilege of speaking before a joint session of the Congress next Monday to lay out his views and seek the views of the Congress, and has gone on immediately beginning his work with what, of course, is a Congress dominated by the opposite party, by saying he would appreciate meeting with the Speaker and other leaders of the Congress immediately following this address in the East Room of the White House. Mr. Ford noted that he takes office under extraordinary circumstances, that this is an hour of history. He said, I am acutely aware that you were not elected, that I was not elected by your ballots, but he asked the American people to confirm him by their prayers. He took rather direct note of the Watergate tragedy, which has led to the departure of President Nixon, saying that our long national nightmare is over, our Constitution works, our great republic is a nation of laws and not of men. And he spoke of binding up the internal wounds of Watergate, which he said are more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, a more direct reference to the problem perhaps than any made by Richard Nixon last night or this morning as he took his farewell. And we noted that President Ford's voice broke as he asked for prayers for Richard Nixon and said, may our former president who brought peace to millions find it for himself. In the East Room now, Hal Walker.
Neil, I was reminded a few minutes ago by our colleague Phil Jones of the line that the former vice president often used in speaking around the country when he would say that all he ever wanted to be really was Speaker of the House, an ambition that he never attained, but he did become vice president, and he said, once in a while, I have to admit that when I drive past the White House on my way to my house in Alexandria, Virginia, a little wee voice does come up and say, if you lived there, you'd be home now. Well, President Jerry Ford is at home now in the White House. The crowd of dignitaries, the leadership of the Congress, members of the cabinet, new advisors, new faces here at the White House who will be advising this new president as the transition takes place from the administration of Richard Nixon to the administration of Gerald Ford. Mr. Ford's family seated in the front row, beaming proudly, smiling, the mood completely different from the mood that we witnessed here in the East Room just a few hours ago as Richard Nixon departed. And now the crowd waiting to go out, a bit of a jam up at the doorway. A little while earlier we heard one of the service bands playing the martial music that so often accompanies the ceremonies in this room.
Very much the case, Hal Walker. The transition is now made. As they say in monarchies, the king is dead, long live the king. But we now have a new president already on Capitol Hill. We have the passage of a resolution by the Senate promising cooperation with him, and we have a good deal of speculation about what man he will name now as his vice president, who must be confirmed by a majority vote of each house of the Congress. This morning, Hugh Scott, the Republican leader, and Republican Senator Everett Brooke of Massachusetts have both come out in support of Nelson Rockefeller, the former governor of New York. Governor Ronald Reagan of California, however, is pushing Senator Barry Goldwater. So it's one of the decisions that President Ford now has to make in the coming days. And this afternoon, he goes directly into 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time into a meeting with his economic advisors tackling the nation's now number one domestic problem, and that is the state of the economy.
And as you noted, his saying, Neil, these transitions do take place rapidly. President Gerald Ford's first official act then will be to meet with the joint leadership of the Congress, his old friends from Capitol Hill, friends among whom he feels obviously comfortable and I'm sure will be seeking from them their pledge for assistance during these first, which will be rather trying, rather difficult days. It's always difficult when a new administration comes into the White House, just sort of finding your way around, just many of the simple physical logistical problems that have to be taken care of. And this new president, like all new presidents, is going to need all the help he can get.
And Hal, let's listen again now to some of the words of President Ford as he seems to indirectly promise at least a much more open administration than that we have just seen.
I believe that truth is the glue that holds government together. Not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though stained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
So Gerald Ford has taken the oath of office as the nation's 38th president. As he noted, every president since George Washington has taken that oath. It is laid down in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1. The words of that oath, the same oath that Richard M. Nixon, that proposed Article 2 of impeachment, was accused of violating and abusing his power under it. But taking those words now and saying that these are extraordinary times, Gerald Ford has become president of the United States. This has been a CBS News special report. The nation's 38th president takes office. I'm Neil Strausser with Hal Walker, CBS News, Washington.